This is the Empire Podcast, released January 17th, 2022, episode 573, Mixed Signal Education with Philip Salmoni. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
Hi, I'm Philip. I run the Phil's Lab YouTube channel and a professional hardware engineering consultant on the side.
Hey, Philip. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Chris?
Good, good. I was wondering, because, you know, I know you go by Philip, but it's Phil's Lab. So is it like, kind of like you get into the lab and you relax and you're like, oh, call me Phil.
Well, it's always a thing, because Philip's Lab, I think, would sound a bit strange. And also, I never know, because I'm...
See.
From Germany, I'm called Philip, and when I go to England, people usually call me Phil, so I never know what to choose.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I just like that idea of, like, you know, like the lab is your happy place, and that's where you go to relax, and like it's just like a, you know.
That's true. Chill. Yeah, I mean,
chill with Phil. You know,
I think I'll keep that. I'll keep the chill with Phil on my channel now. I think it might make that. Yeah.
If you could do when you do like Q&A sessions, maybe you could do that. You could have like a pipe, and you'd be like, you know, drinking a glass of scotch or something. And
perfect. Yeah, put on a little tweed jacket. I think that sounds good.
Perfect. Yeah.
You're giving me a good idea. So I was running out of content
fire
for
in the
YouTube.
Background. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I wish I just had a fireplace back home. I'm afraid it's a bit lower budget than that. So
Well, or where you are now. So you're in Denmark now, where it's in time of year is a little chilly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's working its way down to fairly low temperatures again. I'm just getting used to it. I thought like Germany and England was bad in terms of weather, but Denmark really does beat that. But
I know how it goes. Well, I knew how it goes.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, after your move now, I guess you can look forward. I guess, does it get pretty hot where you are now?
It does. Yeah, it'll get up in the 40C range with a lot of humidity. So like,
oh my God.
40C and like, you know, 90% humidity. It's a rough time.
I'm not sure if I would make the move to such a warm climate, but not bad.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes. We'll see if I melt this year.
Yeah. Well, I can freeze on the other hand, so I think we'll make a match there.
Yeah. So how long have you been doing the Phil's Lab channel?
Well, it started off as kind of, I was looking into STM32, how to develop your own microcontroller board, going from Arduino to making something more producible or something that looks more professional. And that was, May 2020? I was looking into that and I uploaded this like 3-hour video just for me myself, first of all, just trying to detail how do you make a microcontroller board or with SMD components. And that was really bad audio quality as well. And somehow it got shared around and then took off. So I assume that was the moment where it kind of hit. So May 2020, what's that?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you started, you know, hitting my radar because you were doing stuff in KiCad or KiCad, as you call it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's great. I think specifically, you know, like it was the start to finish tutorial piece of it, like being able to see, like people really love that being able to see everything there. And maybe they, you know, stop it and, you know, take a break after a half hour, or come back to the next day. But being able to see that whole process is super valuable, especially for people that have never done a board before.
Yeah. No, and I think that was also the reason. Another thing is like the KiCad, KiCad. I still don't know how to say it, and I still mess it up. You say KiCad, right?
I say KiCad, but it's really KiCad. Okay. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
I never know, to be honest.
I can't deprogram myself, even if I tried. I've thought about doing a fundraising thing where you know, people could donate to one or the other, and you know, if we hit a certain threshold, I'll stop saying KiCad, but. In my head, it's still always going to be KiCad.
Yeah, almost like a swear jar or something. Every time you say KiCad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a good idea. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, I keep messing it up as well. But yeah, but basically it was the thing. I think I was just scouring through data sheets and application notes, trying to figure out how to... It sounds basic now, but at the time, every time I guess you introduce something new, it was quite difficult. Piecing everything together, what do coupling capacitors need? You need certain pull-ups here. What is like is this boot mode pin do? And I kind of wanted everything in one place. And I guess that then also helped, as you say, quite a lot of other people to see the whole process in one place.
Yeah.
So as a reference, basically, for myself, it started. But
oh, that's great. That's great. And I think that as well with like the, you know, STM32 is this very popular platform. But when people are like, so someone might go and see like a black pill or equivalent kind of dev board that's out there, making that leap from like, a black pill and knowing that there's STM32 on there, and then like being like, well, I want to build my own board, understanding that piece and like the all the other stuff you have to look up, like the data sheet that you're talking about.
Yes.
That's another really valuable piece, I feel like.
Exactly. Yeah, just learning how to read a data sheet and pull stuff together. And I just feel like it enables so much more in terms of projects, being able to just go to data sheet and then pop that in your design rather than relying on plugging in or using an Arduino board and using these weird GPIO headers that always come loose. I don't know if what your experience was with that, or if you had something like that where you moved from an Arduino based system to STM32 or whatever microcontroller you were using.
You know, for me, it was, I came in from the analog side, so it was always weird for me anyways. Like I got to make microcontrollers very late in the game, I feel like.
Okay.
Not late in the game, but late in my career even. You know, a lot of my stuff, I started out in the analog space. And so it was like, oh, well, there's digital people taking care of that. And, you know, where I was starting at Keithley, they were using like 68,000 parts as well. So I was not, I was not super keen to get in on that with like tool chains and all that other stuff too. It wasn't until much later where I was like, oh, this just enables all this other stuff. And so, you know, I went the normal route of, I might have had background of electronics, but I went the normal route of, you know, Arduinos and, you know, then using Adafruit, SparkFun type stuff as well, and just learning like that.
Yeah. So. But you started off with analog design, it's like straight out of uni, or how was that?
Oh, no, no, no. I went to university and learned a little bit about electronics, and then I went to work at Samsung in a chip fab.
Okay.
And I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. And that's like a very specific career path. And so then I went back and went to go work at Keithley Instruments, where my alma mater was. And my friend got me a job. Past guest of the show, Dave Young, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's when I really kind of, that was my true learning. That's what I tell people is like, that's when I really started learning electronics at the age of 25. So 23. Yeah.
But that's really cool. Because after I graduated, I know for graduates, it's probably a lot harder to find like analog design jobs. But that, me, is one of the coolest part of electronics is analog design. It's a shame you probably need quite a lot of years of experience to actually then get into that field. I mean, Keithley, they do like measurement equipment, test equipment, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's not as needed these days because of all the other stuff that's out there. You know, like you go, I'm sure you've read like Jim Williams' app notes from Linear Technology, right? Like his app notes are amazing, but like you go and look at all the stuff that's in there. Like one of his best app notes is how to do a thermocouple, like a really precise thermocouple measurement circuit.
Okay.
And for a long time that was like, and like it still holds up as a circuit. It's still like a very, you know, it's got like a digital drive circuit to with like some logic gates to drive one side of a transformer to send data, you know, so it's isolated and stuff like that. And like, it is a very interesting, very cool circuit. But these days you can literally buy, well, outside of the past 2 years, you can just go and buy a thermocouple circuit that is at or better than that performance. Mm-hmm. And it's almost irresponsible to go and do what he did if you were a design engineer. You know, that's just kind of the world we're living in now. And so I feel like, you know, the analog stuff is like super intriguing, super fun kind of design and debug stuff. But if you were put on the spot by a company and said, design me a thermocouple circuit, it's like, that is not the right answer, I don't think. I don't know what your experience has been with that.
No, I completely agree. It's always, but as you say, it's kind of the fun of developing or understanding what actually goes on in an analog circuit. But then the day you would just choose an IC to do the job for you and could do it a million times better. I had the same thing when I was quite into audio electronics. And if you wanted to just design your own discrete operational amplifier, for example, yeah, you might get lower noise levels, but the effort and the gain versus just buying like, you know, an E5032, it's like marginal compared to the design cost and board space and so on.
Yeah.
But I just love it as a learning experience, and I wish there were just more jobs, or maybe I was born too late. I should have been born, you know, 20, 30 years ago to be able to do that kind of stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Jim Williams, didn't you have like a, it's almost like a cookbook or something. We had some really tough analog design questions. I saw that on a YouTube channel called like DevTTYS0. I don't think the guy actually still runs it anymore, but he was looking like some Jim Williams, really bizarre questions on analog circuitry. And that's really something mental to test like your knowledge. But
yeah, that's a good, I mean, it's a good way to do it. I don't know about the specific test.
Yeah.
I know that I have the books where they kind of packaged up all of Bob Dobkin's and Jim Williams' app notes. It's called Analog Circuit Design, like Volume 1 and 2.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting to go look through. But I don't know about the test you're talking about specifically.
Yeah, I can't remember. I not sure it's entirely a test. It was basically a book with a collection of examples, and he would give you a circuit and then tell you, or how do you design a circuit to do this certain function?
Oh, okay.
For the life of me, can't remember it, of course, now. But yeah, on that YouTube channel, as I said, I think that's where you can find it. But
okay, but I'll go look at that. Okay. Yeah, that's the dev TTY you said, zero?
TTY is zero, something like that.
Okay.
It has some pretty cool videos on, like, you know, Salon key filters, a lot of analog electronics, and a shame he didn't continue with his videos. But
yeah. I mean, just, well, as you know, the stress of YouTube is, it is a harsh mistress. That's true. Always wanting more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you then went away from analog design, or how did you then progress after Keith?
I went to ABB after that.
Okay.
Big in Europe, right?
Yes, very. Yeah.
And then after that, you know, into marketing type stuff. And yeah, I kind of took a right turn and then came back to it, you know, came back to the technical side. That's what I've been excited about.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it's wanting to build stuff on an everyday basis. And I don't know, it's just the stuff that we, you know, both of us like doing, right? It's like building up circuits and stuff like that. I mean, you have all these designs. One of the things I really like about your videos is that you have a lot of stuff around, like, mixed signal, which I feel like is kind of a, you know, it's kind of getting into that analog side of things and all the analog considerations, but still using all these chips that require, or that maybe don't have to do all the discrete analog design.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, it's kind of also the thing, because I'm a musician and I've always wanted to kind of combine electronics with audio. And as soon as you want to combine audio with electronics, you're going to have to look at some sort of analog side, especially if I was making or designing this guitar pedal, this effects pedal, which you can essentially reprogram to do distortions over, like, reverbs, delays. And of course, for any ADC or DAC, you're going to have to design the analog circuitry around it. And once you've done it, like, a couple times, you know how to do it. But yeah, it's this kind of mix and boundary, which I think is quite interesting, not getting too deep into designing the best analog front end or the best, you know, DAC interface, but
something
between.
I think balancing costs too, right? I mean, that's, could spend $30 on a DAC and it's like, all right, well, that might have the specs you think you need, but, like, can you optimize so that you can spend $2 on a DAC and, you know, still make it sound pretty good, or, you know, like all of the engineering trade-offs that are required, especially audio, where kind of people have an idea of what they think they want, but then actually, like, tying it back to truly needed specifications has got to be kind of tough.
And that's the thing. And you see all this audio hype, you know, 24-bit analog digital converters running at almost 200 kilohertz of a sample rate, when it actually comes down to it, you know, much lower is even fine, and just finding that kind of balance.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I think it's a really interesting field, mixed signal. And that's also, as I guess, shared with you, was the mixed signal course that kind of tries to at least outline some of these design procedures, both on the analog and the digital side. And I kind of wanted to summarize at least my findings over the last few years into something that is kind of accessible for someone new to that field.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the course. So you have a new course available. This is it's hosted on the same, on Robert Fahrenheit's Fedevel site, but it's your course on there, and people can follow along and do it. What's kind of, like, what's the outline of the course?
Yes, exactly. So it's hosted with or by Robert Fahrenheit, who runs Fedevel Academy. His kind of sub-site is called Fedevel Education, where other people that are invited can publish their own courses. So yeah, the outline of the course is essentially starting you through a whole design procedure for a mixed signal product or prototype. So you're given a very basic design description. So it should be a USB-based signal generator and signal analyzer. You're trying to minimize cost. And how do you go from a really very vague design description to a final product that you can order at a manufacturing house? So I start off giving you the design description and then deriving the system requirements kind of step by step. What does the USB need to be capable of? What kind of data rates you need? And that means what kind of USB protocols do you need? What microcontroller with flash and RAM and so forth, leading through analog circuit design, digital circuit design, and then in KiCad, which is V6, which has also just been released, or last month, I believe.
Exciting,
Through PCB layout and routing, how to choose parts, how to cost optimize, how to design interfaces, and then actually getting it ordered. So it was kind of hard to pack all that information in, you know, five-ish hours. But
I think it gives you a ton in 5 hours.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, if you can, leave a link to the course description, and it is just the description of the course or the content, though, just like in bullet points as a list, is quite a number of pages. So I hope it's it's hard. I don't know, with your course, also finding the balance of how much information do you put in, how long do you make the course and the lessons and so on. So I wasn't sure being yeah. that this is the first course.
Yeah, I think what you're going to find is this is like definitely like intermediate level. I think mm-hmm. this is, you're going to need a lot of people that are interested in this sort of thing because of the audio. And I think you're going to get people taking it. Unfortunately, they're probably going to not have, hopefully they can just follow along, which I think there's always value in that kind of building muscle memory, following mm-hmm. along, watching you do layout, copying the layout. That actually has a lot of benefit. But like, if they then are like, all right, I'm going to go design my own custom thing now, it's like, ooh, yeah. You know, like,
yeah.
That's a huge jump. And I always like to think about Akiba, we've had on the show a couple times in the past. He and I used to talk about, like, he would always talk about breakdancing, and I would talk about like jazz. But mm-hmm. I feel like in the same way, like the first thing you have to do is learn how other people did it, right? You know, like,
yeah.
like Charles Mingus didn't play like a banging solo the first time mm-hmm. he played. It was like he would learn the classics first and all of the basics and like how music is structured. And then yeah. eventually you start to modify and play. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is like having these kind of examples on your course or Robert's courses or my courses, like it's just about at the beginning, just following along. And like, as I tell people, so many other things can go wrong. Just try and follow the example yeah. first and mm-hmm. make sure you get through it. And if not, you'll learn a lot from that, things going wrong.
Exactly. It's almost like a thing when you, the first step when I look at a new IC is look at, you know, reference schematics, reference designs. And in essence, is what you say, you look at the reference design, think, okay, how the hell am I going to do that? And just go through part by part. Yeah. And I hope the yeah. course kind of details that a bit more, that you're not on your own.
Yeah.
You're kind
yeah.
of guided through. And also found that not a lot exists on actually choosing or how to select parts. And it's mm-hmm. questions I often get on the YouTube channel as well, is how do you even begin? How do I know I need this STM32F3 part yeah. or this specific resistor? So
yeah. I think about, like, you know, like you tell someone, all right, you're gonna go choose an op amp. And they're like, okay, where do I go? And you're like, oh, you go to DigiKey. And they go to DigiKey and they're like, whoa, what is going on yeah. here?
Yes, exactly.
Like, well, the thing is, you learn to like it.
yeah, exactly, yeah.
There's other flavors. You can try Mauser if you want. You can go mm-hmm. to Element 14 if you want. Really, you know, pick your poison, folks. It's
yeah.
They got all the parts, so I don't know what you don't have a choice.
Yeah, and it's just so, it must be, I mean, it still is overwhelming, right? Going to like a mouse totally. Or DigiKey part search yeah. and just, okay, what do I actually choose? But kind of over time, I guess you also like develop your favorite parts or familiarity. Mm-hmm. So you're always like, I go to STM32 for a microcontroller, someone else might go to TI or Microchip, but mm-hmm. you kind of build up, I guess, a little like parts reservoir, things you always want to go with.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I always talk about like a mental library. I think that's, mm-hmm. you know, and one thing that's nice is, like, you know, watching videos like yours, even if I'm not, you know, yours or Robert's or Dave's or anyone's like that, right? One thing mm-hmm. I'm doing is just kind of filing just the names in the back of my head so that when I hear it later, when I hear an idea later, like, oh, I need to do, you know, a DAC circuit. I'm like, oh, I can mm-hmm. watch Philip's video on mixed signal stuff and just go and look at that and use that as a reference. And then almost having that as a, like a centralized location to start my search party out from, you know, like, oh, I want a 16-bit DAC or I want a 12-bit DAC. And mm-hmm. here's the stuff that Philip thought was important. And do I think all this stuff's important around it as well? It's just so hard to, when you look at all of the specs that are on a spec sheet, to know what to care about.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's even harder if you're doing this on your own or as a hobby and having no one to ask. So in a company, I guess it's different because you usually have a mentor. Yeah. I don't know. I guess when you started at Samsung, right? And then Keithley, I guess you had people around you to, I guess, supervise or design review.
At Keithley, there was not only was there, you know, mentors, like unofficial mentors, but then there were so many analog engineers there. We would have a meeting like with like 15 to 20 analog engineers in a room just talking about analog topics. And it's like, that's, man, you can't, you literally couldn't pick a better place to like learn about that kind of stuff.
That is
so
really
that
cool.
I feel very grateful for that.
That's really cool. Yeah.
It's not common, right? I mean, like, no. I don't know how you would do that otherwise.
No, it's also a thing. It's one thing I've also been noting because I've been working with Scale-Up for, I guess, one and a half years almost now. And that's the thing. I am the only guy doing electronics. So having no one to ask, it's kind of cool, of course, having the responsibility to make a product just by yourself. Mm-hmm. But especially like I graduated, I don't know, 3 years ago. So I'm not the most experienced person. So it, of course, would be nice to ask someone else. And just joining a startup, I found that quite difficult. Like, who do you actually ask? Because no advice is really free. Of course, you can go to YouTube and sign up to courses, but yeah. In that sense, no, it would be good.
I found in the absence of, you know, so I also was at startup. I'm currently at startup. I mean, like I find that, like, you know, a lot of it is, you know, you could do media type stuff, you know, finding people on YouTube, like you mentioned, if your company is big enough or has the connections, or even if they don't, you could probably reach out and, you know, like, I think applications engineers are like my lifeline for everything, you know, but like trying to get their attention is usually the tough part, if, you know, especially at a startup. But some of them are like, oh, startups, that's fun, you know, so, you know, lean into that sort of thing.
So you actually send them just a mail asking, can you detail this, or how do you do it? Really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And actually the best ones I find are actually, you know, there's the specific ones at like a chip company. So if you try and find like an ST like app engineer, that might be tough. But if you have like a distributor with like some technical resources, I feel like they're like, if you can just like do a call with them and just talk through a design, because the other nice thing is the trade there is usually the information, right? They want to know like, oh, well, Philips got this design and it's got a DAC and an ADC and a microcontroller and all these other things. And they want to suggest other stuff in there. And so if you're willing to, you know, kind of open the kimono a little bit and show like, oh, here's what my design kind of consists of, they're going to be like, oh, well, let me offer you some more parts. But in doing so, they can often offer you advice and, you know, some guidance, which is very, very helpful.
That's a very good tip. No, I will definitely try that in the future.
Yeah.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to explore this via the YouTube, at least having that as a backing to say, okay, you know, you're not just an individual asking for little advice. You can always kind of in return ask for a promotion or offer promotion. Mm-hmm. Try and do that to ask for advice. But I'll definitely go with that. That's cool.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is this like, it's this weird kind of ad hoc network of people, you know, really truly based around like commerce and money and stuff like that. So there is always that value transfer. But the nice thing is, if you stay away from the sales side of it, right? If you don't like, you don't usually talk to a sales engineer, you just try and get to the technical person as fast as possible. At the end of the day, that's going to be a nerd. And like, I want to just talk to nerds. Like you know, I want to geek out about a design and just like, oh, like, you know, I thought this was, you know, here's, you know, if you lead with like, oh, I had a problem with this, they're going to be totally into, you know, digging into that problem, I feel like. So
that's a good point. Yeah.
Have you experienced that all in like in Germany or in Denmark? Have you been in touch with that crowd?
Well, it was mainly at university. So at university, I was lucky enough to find a group of people who just loved engineering, even though it's like it's kind of a beginner level, right? You're just learning about basic circuitry and how to root things up. We didn't even have anything about PCB design at university, which is another thing I find bizarre.
Yeah, same.
But yeah, just nerding out with people. I founded with a friend of mine at the time a drone club, you know, maybe building fixed wing aircraft, and just being able to nerd out and try and figure out this system which no one's worked on before, at least at our level, was pretty cool. And just being able to nerd out, and the same thing in a startup, you're just surrounded by people who are passionate about making technology, especially an engineering startup. And yeah, I mean, I haven't actually worked on a larger aerospace company for a very few months when I left university, but that just wasn't for me. So I don't think I'm just the person to work in a large company, you know, 9 to 5 and do that thing. I prefer this kind of work.
Yeah. I mean, the benefit of a big company is like, often you'll be able to find other people that might be a mentor you know, technical resources, stuff like that. The downside is they're going to be like, well, Philip, you just designed this one little tiny part and just make sure it works perfectly and go to all these meetings, please. Yeah.
And that's exactly the thing. It's that trade-off of having the like little responsibility versus having people to ask. Mm-hmm. And I prefer the startup life, to be honest, just having that responsibility, trying to figure out a problem by yourself, of course, with a team of other people. But I don't know. But Samsung is a huge company. So I guess you had, and Keithley as well. So I guess you had the more, I don't know, traditional route to start with.
Yeah, I mean, Samsung was like a totally different thing. That was a chip company. So like that was a chip fab. So I was not even doing electronics. I was doing process engineering.
Okay.
But at Keithley, yeah, I mean, that was pretty, the only reason that I was able to like put hands onto like deep technical problems is because it was a pretty small company, actually. It was only like, I think it was like probably 50 total engineers, but they had like a product line that had like 20, 25 products. And so, and I was doing like, you know, new product support you know, release product support. So that helped too, you know, just being the repair, you know, a lot of people talk about being in repair first is a great a great way to see a lot of problems with finished designs and that sort of thing.
And that was straight after university, you said, right?
That was, like 2 years after university.
Okay. So, but did you have anything about PCB design at university?
No. My first design was actually, my first layout was in Eagle, not watching YouTube, just like talking to people. YouTube had not started yet. That makes me sound old.
Okay. What's that? Before 2007, 2006?
Yeah, YouTube, actually, it had just started. So it was 2008, I started it at Keithley, and wow, YouTube wasn't a thing yet. So, you know, just like following guidelines from other people at the company and using Eagle. And, and back when Eagle wasn't owned by AutoCAD, it was like a German, just the German company that started it and had it around for many years. So,
yeah.
Boy, no, Philip, that makes me feel old, I got to say.
I'm sorry. No, you better cut that out. No, no.
No. That's great. Okay. That's great.
Yeah. No, but yeah, I just thought it was such a shame because to me, PCB design is actually one of the most fun parts. And actually, it's not just connect the dots, right?
Right.
It's control impedances, spacing, God knows what, stack ups. And it's a whole another side to engineering I hadn't been even exposed to at university.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, at the university level, I asked that. I remember like asking this. Actually, I went to a thing called the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department Heads Association.
Okay.
And I remember asking a question at like one of the roundtables that was kind of in this realm of like, well, why... You know, why aren't you teaching these things that are practical and, you know, that like people want to learn and stuff like that? And they're like, well, you know, students will learn this over time and we don't have time to learn all these programs or something like that. It's like, I don't care. Like, that's your job is to like teach people this stuff. I don't know. I feel like it's looked down upon maybe in like the echelons of ivory towers of education, but
I understand the fact that you should expose students as much as possible to introduce topics, but in an electronics engineering degree, not even mentioning PCB design or actual circuit design, I find is a bit odd. Instead, we proved, I don't know, like vector calculus, like what was it, Stokes theorem or Gauss's law and things like that. It's bit of a shame.
Yeah, I do feel like it would be a good way to. It almost would be like a good way to, as like a framing for discussions, or I guess it'd be probably more base physics, but like talking about Maxwell's equations and talking about it, like using a PCB trace as a, as an example. But I feel like that because of the separation maybe between physics and electronics or electrical groups, maybe that's why. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I agree. No, but it was, no, it's a shame, but I just hope, because a friend of mine actually introduced me to KiCad when I was at university, and there's like, you know, you see the cool black background, these Tron looking traces, and that kind of got me hooked to start with. But it wasn't actually the university doing that, it was through a friend. So very thankful to him for introducing me to that. But
that's great. That's great. That's
how it all started.
And so that was in, was that in service of that, the fixed wing group that you mentioned?
That was actually a different guy. We went to the same, well, the same university, same course, same year. And he, I don't know how he got into PCB design, but he just showed me this program, gave me the first little pointers. And
I know. And then you're hooked for life, right?
Then you're hooked, right?
That's the beginning and the end. Sorry, man.
Exactly. Connect the dots for adults. I mean, perfect. No, it's only a surprise because it opens a whole world I didn't even know existed. And it's a nice thing to be able to do, because in these days also with S&D components, it enables you to go away from, I don't know, not to sound derogatory, but this hobbyist electronics, you know, where you have these dip components or through-hole resistors, enables you to explore so much more of electronics just being able to design PCBs, I found at least. So
I think the, you know, the hobbyist stuff, or even just the, you know, the beginner stuff of like point-to-point wiring and breadboards and stuff like that, I think that's an important stage in the process. Yep. But like you said, I mean, like, I feel like it's just talking to people about like wanting to put your thing out in the world, just talking about like vibration on a quadcopter or a you know, fixed wing, it's like that breadboard's not going to work. And talking through it with people that are like, okay, yeah, so how do we make this more permanent? Well, circuit board's the way. And I think that transformation is very helpful for people.
Yeah, no, definitely. As you say, like breadboarding definitely has its place and is great. And also for audio, like if you're just trying to, you know, design different filters or anything like that, breadboard, you can't beat that.
Yep.
But enabling the use of these really small chips or FPGAs or God knows what, I think if you can design PCBs yourself, it's such a plus. Mm-hmm. And also, just working on projects, at least that's what I found with employers. being able to have your own project, have design PCBs, that was a huge plus.
Oh yeah.
Makes you just really stand out.
Standing out in the marketplace. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
People that are watching your videos, I mean, so you get a lot of feedback mm-hmm. from people that watch the videos and stuff like that. What are people coming in with knowledge wise? I mean, I guess people coming to the course now, but coming to YouTube prior to that, what is the level of people coming in?
I think it's quite mixed. So I would say it's usually beginner intermediate. I think it is that stage where you're kind of, you've explored most of the capabilities of Arduino, and then you're looking into, for example, how do I put the 80 mega that is used in an Arduino on a PCB?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
So that kind of level. So a lot of times university students studying electronics, hobbyists, advanced hobbyists, that kind of area. I don't think, you know, many professional people watch the videos. Maybe they do, but judging by the comments,
people listen to the Amp Hour. We've referred to it before. Okay. So yeah.
Okay.
I think you'd be surprised. No, I mean, like, there's a lot of, that's the other thing too. Like, you know, even when you've been doing this for, you know, a bunch of years, it's, mm-hmm. I can still learn a ton of stuff. I have learned a ton of stuff from your videos. So like, that's the great thing is just like being able to see having lots of examples at hand. Much like the Jim Williams book of application stuff. It's just mm-hmm. like, it's so nice to be able to see that. Even if I'm like, oh, I think I know this. It might be something small within that circuit that I could then go and crib later, you know?
Yes. No, true. That's a good point. Yeah. And I've tried to initially started, you know, with KiCad and PCB, but I've tried to like branch out a bit with like signal processing and control systems. So luckily the viewers have responded well and like kind of follow the channel along that way as well. Because
What kind of stuff are you doing there?
So a lot on various fundamentals of signal processing. So how do you design IR or FIR filters, mainly digital signal processing, and then also stuff like sensor fusion, extended Kalman filters. How do you do state estimation? How do you design a control system given, you know, a certain system? Kind of a mix of different things that I've personally find interesting and have needed in personal projects.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, you got to figure other people are going to be doing that stuff too. And I feel like something like a Z transform too. That's something where mm-hmm. you know, you learn that in a digital processing class, and it's like, oh, okay, I understand the math.
Exactly.
But like actually like using it in the real world and like needing it for a filter design, it's like, oh, wait a second, this.
Exactly.
You know, I wish they would have started with that. I hope that a college professor puts on your video first thing and is like, hey, here's why you really need this.
Exactly. And it's, to me, that is still talking with like Z transform digital systems, just the fact that you can add numbers in a certain way and multiply them in a certain way gives a different frequency response is mental.
Yeah. Like, yeah, totally right.
What was it? The Fibonacci series. You know, you can write that as a linear difference equation. Take the Z transform of the difference equation of the Fibonacci series, and it has a frequency. It doesn't make sense, of course, in that context, but just the fact that you can do that, I always thought was mental. But on that note, But
no, I think that's good though too. I mean, I think it's like showing the wonders of the, you know, the math and the physics that's all around us.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you know, I feel like that is just the, you know, kind of go back to the education piece. That's the step that always kind of gets skipped. And it's at least what I was the hungriest for, because I had such a hard time like sticking with it and like understanding why I should be doing these stupid problems over and over again. And it's like, but you can do all this cool stuff with it. You know, they should start with the cool stuff. Always start with the cool stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's almost like when I was at university, my main resource was YouTube, because as you say, that's where you see kind of more practical things. You get exposed to university, but then to me, it was the university of YouTube kind of filling in those gaps and seeing how you can actually implement that.
Yeah. Well, Philip, let me tell you the other things that didn't exist when I was at university.
Oh, God. Yes. Sorry. I'm sorry for bringing that up again.
Yeah, the iPhone.
Exactly. What my
most
dad's...
of the internet.
That,
Gmail.
Fair enough. You definitely had it harder. My dad always tells me about, you know, the slide rules and not having a calculator. Yeah. So that's even further back. But
I can't even. Yeah. You know, I was just re-listening to Richard Feynman. Surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman.
Yeah.
And he was talking about just like how proud he was about like the being able to estimate like log tables and stuff like that. I was like, why the hell would anyone care about that? And it's like, actually that makes you like 1,000 times more capable as a physicist, because there wasn't the calculation capabilities then.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah.
Yeah. How we've moved on.
I'm not trying to be like, you know, kids these days, kind of, even though I did say that last week.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually great. I think that it lets you get to the fun stuff faster, right? It lets you get to the application level stuff faster.
Exactly.
Instead of getting bogged down in the like, oh, you know, why do I even care about any of this stuff? It's just straight to the, well, I need this tool. Here's how you do it. Watch Phil's video and then you're good to go. You know, like, it's great.
Exactly. Yeah. And it just drives everything further as well to me, faster rate. I mean, it's crazy. Wasn't it like on a credit card, you have more computing power than the first moon landing had?
Yeah, probably. Stuff like that.
But no, it's cool. I mean, what, as you say, kids these days, what toys they can play with, and they don't have to, you know, use an abacus or something. So
right.
It's pretty cool.
So then I think the challenge is when you have all of the world's knowledge at your fingertips, it's like literally it's an attention problem at that point of like, mm-hmm. okay, well, I know I want to do this thing. I know I want to make a guitar pedal.
Yeah.
How do I do it? And then it's like, because I don't know about you, but I've been on many a rabbit hunt down a rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been on Wikipedia and just like, by the end of it, I'm like, I don't even know what I'm looking at anymore. You know, I just wanted to find an op amp, and now I'm, you know, 15 pages deep on Wikipedia. And it's like, why am I looking at this?
I very much know the feeling. Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's also a thing being able, like not knowing what to choose, what to do next. Because there's so many cool projects or things to do. Or even just looking at the details, like you look at an op amp, and then you look through, okay, how does an op amp work? What does the input stage do? And then you dive deep and deep, and you kind of want to explore that and be able to do that. I just have such a hard time choosing what project to do next. Because they all just sound like pretty cool. I don't know how you do that, or you even have the time outside of work to do your own projects.
Yeah, I mean, these days I don't.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
But I think honestly, having like a secondary hobby though that feeds into it, that mm-hmm. has been, I think that's a great way to do it. I mean, you've posted music videos, I believe, in the past as well.
Yeah, yeah. I try to design when I have the time. Guitar pedals, guitar amplifiers, either if they're just analog or, you know, mixed signal. I think that's, as you say, it's cool being able to combine both of your interests, or if you have more, of course, multiple of your interests. And I think that's even what almost got me into electronics. So I started playing guitar, I don't know, 15 years ago, and always thought, okay, like, how does this guitar pedal even work? This distortion, even though it has a single transistor and a couple passes around it. And then finally being able to design it yourself and understand that, it's really rewarding.
No, that's great. That's great. Yeah. And I think having that goal in mind is really important too, because you know you want the pedal at the end or whatever. Yeah. You've probably opened up other pedals, you've seen what's involved, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And it kind of repeats everything. Is once you've seen like one guitar pedal of a certain type, like a distortion pedal, you've almost seen them all, and it's interesting to play around with that and then copy a bit and kind of go along. And what kind of interest did you have that merged with electronics? Was it also audio or music?
It was some audio stuff. I mean, I don't even know that anymore. You know, I got into some of the Badge Life stuff. So like doing Blinkies and, you know, just stuff that I found laying around. I don't know. It's probably not the same. I mean, test equipment stuff a little bit, but not nearly as much as people like Dave.
Yeah.
So yeah. Mm. Yeah, I never really had like a really good... I remember talking to one of the engineers at Keithley, actually, and I remember asking him, like, well, what kind of stuff do you work on at home? He's like, I spend 50 hours a week working on really intense analog circuits. When I get home, I ride my bike. And I'm like, okay. You know, like, and I think there is that, you know, sometimes like if you're using up all your daytime hours on electronics, like some people I know that are like the best at electronics are the ones who are like doing software all day, and then they come home at night and they work on electronics or that sort of thing. So usually what I would do is I would work on electronics in the day, and then I'd come home and talk about them on the podcast. So like I always say, podcasting was my hobby, you know?
Okay. No, I mean, that's also sounds like a better balance. I always find it hard to strike, because at work you have to do, you know, certain projects.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then if you have certain other also electronics or engineering projects that you want to work on, you have to do it afterwards. So
Yeah.
For me, it's easy to slip on into the state of just doing electronics the whole day. So I have to stop myself. But
well, you know, luckily we have the part shortage to deal with. So, you know, that is like a governor on our activity and output. So how has that been going with the, I mean, it's all your videos are STM32 based. How's How's it all been going for you?
That's been interesting.
Yeah.
That has been very interesting. It's luckily passives aren't out yet. So at least I only need to have to redesign for the microcontroller. The thing is also sensors. And as you said before we started recording, also with the, you know, switching converters. But on the positive side, I've been very good at, you know, making footprints.
Because that's true. Yeah.
Every week I have to make a new footprint, a new symbol for that. And then,
yeah.
I mean, it's a bit of a challenge to also just then find parts or minimize the design time you need for then redesigning. So maybe in that way, it's also a good practice. And it'll be so nice when it's back to normal at the end of this year. Hopefully at the end of this year.
Hopefully.
Just to have the freedom again to choose.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think one thing that's going to come out of this actually is when I think about like moving up the stack a little bit and like the amount of like maintenance that you'll need to have in order to like maintain multiple versions within organizations. Yeah. So like thinking about people that have 15 revisions of their circuit board and like, what if they have to target something differently? You know, if it's like a power converter, okay, no big deal. But if there's like a sensor difference, now you just branched your firmware and you have to say like, oh, well, Rev A has, you know, this, the BME 280, but Rev B, we can only get the BME 680. And so it's like, so now you have different firmware maybe, and it like, gets loaded differently. So I think what's going to come out of this time is like better tooling around that sort of thing and just really more attention to it because it's been necessitated by the silicon shortage.
No, that's actually a good point. I hadn't thought about that. It's going to be like some sort of n-dimensional branch that just branches out on firmware and...
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, the downside is that it's going to... I think it's going to... You know, people are going to be dragging these things. This is just going to be baggage in organizations for years and years and years.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you've... Say you have put out 5 different versions of your product and you've made 100,000 of each of them, it's like... Those things are not going away anytime soon. So you have to support them and test them. And
that's true. I also wonder how it's going to be because people probably overbuying or hoarding you know, certain ICs, how that's going to like, if it's going to overshoot once production starts ramping up again and then people don't want to buy and then maybe shut it down. I wonder how that is going to run out as well.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. Like, will they just like use up their in-house stock and stuff like that?
Yeah. And if it'll settle again, I mean, I don't actually, what was actually the main reason for causing it? Do you know? Because people say, you know, it was Corona, it was some fire in some factory. Well, do you actually know? I'm not too informed.
Not specifically. I mean, I think there's been a lot of push-pull around Corona, but I think a lot of it has been like reacting, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, I talked to a friend recently and he's like, yeah, I switched... You know, I had to switch microcontroller platforms. I'm like, okay, well, you know, that happens. It sucks. But he's like, yeah, then I just like bought 3 reels of the components. I was like, oh. And so then you think about how that hits the supply chain then, because now, maybe there was stock of that one part before my friend bought it out. But now whoever was planning on that stock being in distribution has just hit the same problem. And so it just kind of like moves down the chain.
Okay.
You know, it's like.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, for companies that have enough capital to deal with that, I guess it's still kind of okay. So if it's a big car company or God knows what, but hobbyists and also as I've seen in the startup, it's a real trouble. And you, I mean, luckily like governments and loans and God knows what are usually more lenient because of the chip shortage and because of Corona, but it's been a real problem having to redesign, not being able to get enough chips. And if you don't have the financials to actually purchase a certain amount to fit your design or production needs. That's what I've seen is a real problem, but
I think that's gonna, you know, we're 2 years in now and it's like some companies are just like running on fumes and running on their backs, you know, their back stock basically, and just hope, you know, just clearing out their shelves and selling everything underneath themselves. But hopefully, you know, hopefully the builds are going there. I think also hopefully like the, you know, the distributors are giving credit and stuff like that too, or CMs are giving credit, but it's tough in the small kind of volumes. Yeah. I mean, what kind of volumes are you usually designing in?
Usually for in the startup, at least for like the 50 to hundreds, which isn't huge, of course, in comparison, but then again, it's an early stage startup. It's existed for just over a year, but it's still at a volume in that if you need, I mean, a certain PCB I was making, fairly complicated, you know, over 500, 600 parts, various different ICs, and you have to redesign for all of them or have those in stock for 100 and then times, I don't know how many components are on that board. That can be a serious problem for startups. So
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, as a consultant, how much have you had a problem with that when you're doing designs for clients?
Yeah, I mean, basically it's just having hard conversations with them and be like, look, here's the reality right now. You can either buy and hold all the stock up front so that you're certain that you can build this thing. And even still, you know, you're going to make some hard decisions on what is or isn't in your product because of that. Or I'm going to, you know, as the consultant, I'm going to redesign it three times just to work with whatever's there. And then there's just less reliability. Like, so then it's either I have to put more testing towards it, or we have to just kind of cross our fingers, or, you know, and so it really depends where it is in the life cycle of the product. But it's just a crap situation all around. It just sucks. Yeah. It's no fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Like people have been saying on Twitter, it's just not fun to be in hardware right now. And it's like, it's not, but it's important.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's been kind of stressful, as you say, because every time you make a design change, even just designing on it, it's making a small change, but having to change ICs every single time, it's the most stressful thing, waiting for your boards to come back and hoping they'll work.
Yeah. Right. But exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so like, I think, you know, again, like other like silver lining type things are like, there's going to be modernization of documentation systems just because you have to like, you know, there's just more churn right now. Like, so everything that churn results in, I think, you know, so you need to be able to document it better. You need to be able to write more flexible firmware. You need your sourcing groups to be a little bit better about maybe paying for things up front, whether they were like net 30, net 60 before. You know, it's just like, you do what you got to do. But I think it'll be operationally better for companies at the end of the day.
Yeah. No, that's very, very true. And there's also, aren't they making new like fab houses or fab plants in the US now because of this? I mean, that's going to take ages, I assume, to even set up.
Yeah. I mean, they're all targeting at the top end. You know, like that's the real problem is that like, yeah, so Intel might be buying new, or, you know, putting up new fabs, or TSMC is talking about putting some second gen fabs here. Samsung's growing, my own employer. Yeah. But it's like, that's not what I care about. You know, I want TI to reopen their Richardson plant to full capacity. And like, I want some of the Silicon Valley plants that are doing like 100 millimeter wafers and stuff like that. You know, it's just like the stuff where it didn't make financial sense and they all moved it overseas. And now it's like, no, open those back up, please.
Definitely. But how do you do it then on a, like a personal level, like as a, for your own personal projects, if you work on them, do you just design it like, you know, a week before and trying to send it off as quickly as possible? Or
I have taken the tact that I will not send out a circuit board for design until I have the parts in hand.
Yeah.
Because I've gotten burned so many times. So basically my latest design, I ordered a bunch actually from LCSC, not from DigiKey, because there was a bunch of stuff I couldn't get. Mm-hmm. And so I bought a bunch of parts, like enough to build 50, even though I only need 5. So I'm part of the problem. And then I sent off the board because I was just like, the time to wait that small amount of time is worth it versus getting to the end and then being like, that's available.
So, yeah.
Yeah. How about for you?
Well, because I'm lucky enough to be sponsored by JLC, so I can use their services with the PCBs, and they also have their, you know, that parts library.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, of course, it's great because I can just use them and I know what I'm getting, but I can't like pre-order parts unless they're like a minimum quantity. So I don't want to get 1,000 STM32s because I'm maybe bankrupt. But that makes it hard. So I have to design really quickly. So usually I design fairly simple boards for the YouTube channel. And that's pretty much where I use JLC PCB for. So I can do it like a day or two in advance and then just try and order it. But of course, sometimes that doesn't work out and the parts do go very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's crazy, right? I mean, I've been designing this FPGA, you know, the Xilinx Zynq FPGA system on chips.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been designing all of that. And that's where I have gone the route like you have, like pre-ordering the parts, getting them in and then finishing the design.
Wow.
So yeah. That's the kind of route I go with more involved projects.
And that's like a lot per chip too, right? That's like $100 minimum per chip as well.
Exactly. So
like
and crazy. They've gone up as well, the prices for that. So
I'm surprised everybody's not charging $1,000 a chip at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. But that's actually quite a cool little project. I'm trying to make like a system on module for the Zynq.
For work or for fun?
Just for fun, to be honest.
Oh, it's, cool. Okay.
I wanted to make... Well, first, a flight control system based on the Zynq, just to see, or some sort of general control system. But then I think, okay, I could also use this for like audio processing. So yeah. Instead of making a dedicated board for each, I just went the route of making a system on module that I can just plug in, you know, via board to board mezzanine connectors.
So you're kind of going modular at that point, right? You're
exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been interesting to like routing DDR memory, routing out a BGA with like fairly fine pitch and adding peripherals. So that's quite different to the stuff you usually see on the YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But of course, quite a lot more involved than like STM32 designs or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, have you done a lot of Zinc stuff or a lot of FPGA stuff in your work?
A lot of my age is going to be showing here again. The last time I did anything professionally with a FPGA, it was the Vertex 4.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's been a long time. So.
Okay. Well, at least you didn't say like PAL or PLA circuitry.
Yeah, no, that's more like Dave's. That's like Dave's realm. He did a lot of CPLD and PAL stuff.
Okay.
But he also did, to be fair, he also did a lot of other FPGA stuff after that.
Okay.
I feel like this is another like application level thing. I feel like audio could play well in this realm. A lot of like anything like streaming is really good in that way.
Yeah.
But you know, just the smaller stuff that I'm normally doing, it doesn't feel like that's as necessary.
Yeah. No.
How has it been on the software side, like actually setting up the software tool chain for doing like an audio thing with the Zinc?
So the whole Zinc thing is in general also with FPGAs. It's quite a steep learning curve. So luckily the tools from Xilinx, and I believe also from Intel or whatever they used to be, Altera.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, luckily they're free for most chips they have, but it's quite a steep learning curve just setting up and writing your own like VHDL or Verilog and then setting it up. And I'm still yet to produce those boards. So I've done the layout and routing and the schematics. So actually doing a board bring up for something you've designed yourself rather than using, you know, like a Digilint board, or some sort of developer board that's to me still something that lies ahead. So it'll be interesting to see how that board bring up goes. Also like things like testing DDR, you know, writing a script that actually tests that your board layout works. And they're not exactly like cheap to produce these boards when you have God knows how many layers with impedance control and you're doing it as a hobby thing. So that'll be interesting to do.
How many layers of the board have to be for a Zinc chip?
So 6 at least. I'm doing it with 8 just because at least from my experience, is if you go over 8, it's kind of not poolable usually, and it quite increases the cost. Also, if you want controlled impedance, so 8 is what I'm trying to do.
I didn't know. I haven't actually seen any pooled services for 8 layer. I've seen 2, 4, 6 for sure.
So I have I don't know. I usually use Euro circuits otherwise for work and for if I can't use like the JLC PCB parts catalog. So they, I think, have a pooled 8 layer.
Oh, cool.
Which is fairly inexpensive. But that, of course, is in Europe. So for US customers, I'm not sure how.
It's not too bad, actually. EuroCircuits is pretty big name for going across the pond. But but yeah, they're DFM tools, too. Really, really great.
I love those, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. So useful. Save my butt once.
Exactly. Yeah. No, definitely. And they're really quick as well. So
yeah,
I'm very happy also with work with them. So yeah. So hopefully that will come on the YouTube channel at some point, some sort of Zinc-based tutorials. And
yeah.
But that is...
I feel like that's another big shift, though, too, is like, you know, so now you're like, okay, you're learning circuit design stuff and people are like, all right, I get that. And it's like, okay, well, we're going to do, you know, processor stuff. Okay. Yeah, I get that. And now FPGA stuff is like, oh shit.
Yes.
You know, it's just like a whole different paradigm of like how to think about programming. It's barely programming. Yeah. I mean, it is programming, but it's very different that way.
Exactly. So. But I hope it's like kind of like I'm learning with this as well. And I hope you can kind of like take the viewers along, as cheesy as it sounds, but like for the ride.
That's great.
You know, that I'm learning and trying to show, okay, I've moved from STM32 to something like a Zinc and it's, you know, something like that.
So have you done like the Digilint board side of things in the past?
Exactly. Yes. So I've got a couple. I've got like the RT one, which is the Spartan. Got the Zybo, which is the Zinc one. And it's, of course, useful to kind of like then build up or code for those and then use some of those ideas to bring that into your own board. So luckily Digilint has a lot of these reference schematics available. And then quite frankly, I am copying quite a fair bit from them just because it works. But I think
it's just like we talked about at the beginning. It's like you copy it and you're still going to mess stuff up just because you're copying it and you'll learn from that, you know? Like,
You root everything but one line correctly and you can throw the whole board away.
Yeah. Now you'll be sitting there with a very tiny drill, drilling out that
Exactly.
Layer 3 plane.
Yeah. It looks great. Always these spider webs of cables running around. But no, I think that's, to me, that was the way of just doing it, just playing around with development boards. I guess that's most people's route, I guess, right?
I think so. Yeah. I think that, you know, like that, that same kind of like just following other people's examples and all the samples that are out there. I've been really surprised, you know, as I meet more people kind of in the firmware software realm that are like really good at stuff, the ones who like wow me with their like ability to turn around a demo really quickly, or like people like at hackathons back when those were a thing.
Yeah.
The ability to be able to replicate a demo feels like magic to me, because like you have to kind of like take in all of the stuff that is, are, you know, tangential to maybe an idea. You then have to be able to follow directions very well. Obviously that's its own kind of skill, but then like being able, like knowing what knobs to tweak then too. It's almost like when people are looking at DigiKey and they're like, I don't even know what to look at or what to tweak. When I look at like an API, I'm like, what? There's so much stuff here. You know, like it's just like, and like being able to like sit, you know, have a little discomfort with it, but then like being able to be like, all right, I know how to do this. I know how to interact with an API, and like, and then like which knobs to turn. You can do some really cool stuff there, and you're going to learn so many other things in the process, because, you know, the tool chain might break or whatever else. So it's its own kind of skill set, I feel like.
No, exactly. Yeah. No. And it's, and it's cool just being able to explore all these different areas and then just build up and build up. So
I wonder
what's next after that. But let's see.
Yeah, building a spaceship or something, man.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Because FPGAs always seem to be like the pinnacle, like once you've reached FPGA level, you know, what's beyond that in the digital domain. But I just think it's pretty exciting. Just, again, opens more doors. It's like moving from Arduino to SCM32, or then that's the next thing. So
I think that's good. I think about like, you know, because FPGAs are so good at like high speed and like, you know, fast throughputs type of stuff, I always think like that's a really well targeted at like learning video or learning like high speed protocol type stuff, you know, like being able to push a lot of data around. That's where FPGAs really shine. And I feel like if you can find interesting applications there, you know, maybe you make a filter that goes into your camera because you do all these YouTube videos, right? So
exactly. Yeah. Somewhere like that. And also kind of maybe trying to also ease the learning curve for others, because it is quite steep, especially with FPGAs. So I hope that I can, you know, make a video or two just demonstrating like this will get you maybe started quicker. But let's see. That's that's the goal for this year, but let's see.
Yeah, I think I think even if people are picking up like, you know, just a thing here or there from the overall video, then that's still, it's still valuable, you know? Like we were kind of talking about at the beginning with like, you know, so I look at a Jim Williams app note and I look at like, again, back to that thermocouple circuit. Most of that I'm like, this is not for me. But there might be, you know, one thing that's in there that even if I just learn it for that one thing and put that in my mental library, that's super useful. You know, I might run into a similar problem later and be able to refer back to it and then really dig in. And thing with like FPGAs. I feel like it's like if you can kind of take a zoom back and and say, not just here's how you do it, but here's why it's important. And that's what a lot of your videos do well, is like, then people can, you know, come back to it as they need to.
I hope that I can do something along those lines. It's always, I don't know. I mean, also, do you still do courses as well?
My courses are still there, but I'm not actively designing anything new. So
it's a thing of also coming up with content, I guess, for YouTube that is different or not already on YouTube. So I hope that's one thing to add, as you say.
Yeah, I think, you know, doesn't even have to be that different. I think, you know, like it's that I remember like when I started doing courses and stuff like that, I was like really worried. I was like, oh no, someone's going to do exactly the course that I'm doing. And then I was like, yeah, but actually that would be great, because then there would be different ways to see the same thing as well. You know, like, and I was thinking about it because it was like, I was going to invest all this time and then, you know, no one was going to be interested, but people are going to be interested because of the way I do my stuff or the way you do your stuff. And like, people are invested in you. So I feel like that is also
a good point. Yeah.
They're coming towards, you know, like I'm sure that many people that are signing up for your course, hopefully some people here listening are interested, and I would recommend it.
That'd be very nice.
But,
thank you.
I'm sure a lot of them are going to be people that are already familiar with your videos and like your style.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. Yeah. And even if it's just something, as you say, just a small thing you pick up, I guess that's all even worth quite a bit. It doesn't have to be the whole, I mean, I guess a lot of people will be familiar with most of the content in the course, at least if they're signing up for it. But if you can just pick up one or two things that will improve your designs in the future, then
exactly.
I hope that's worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think watching other people design, you know, it's like, what's a good example? I mean, like watching other people paint, right? Is you can learn stuff from their technique, and you might watch the whole painting, but only take one thing out of it, but it's still a worthwhile thing.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Let's talk a little bit more about the course to close this out. I mean, so we kind of talked through some of the various sections there, but was there anything there that like you think is something that is in every design that people should be like focused on, like pull-up resistors or ESD protection? That's using one example there.
Yes. No, I mean, on the point of ESD protection, I think that is also something I get asked a lot about. And there's actually quite a lot of detail to choosing the right ESD protection, you know, depending on what bus speeds or signal speeds you're using, what frequencies you're interested in, or what voltages you're running at. So that is listed in the course as well. I can't go into, or don't go into much detail given the time of the course. But these small things that oftentimes in the YouTube videos, or because maybe even ESD protection is integrated into certain chips, like SM32 might have internal ESD protection, but of course ESD protection should be placed, for example, close to a connector. It should be rated appropriate to what voltages you'll be working with. Mm-hmm. Small tips like that that you maybe not usually find in maybe the YouTube videos I'm doing. So it goes into more and more detail rather than, okay, here's a chip, here's some pull-up resistors. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the whole process you need to think about when you are designing a product, even if it's just a prototype.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just hopefully just little tidbits, kind of a whole span. It's fairly broad, and you know, even with like ESD protection or EMI filtering, you could make a whole course just about that.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So it's almost like presenting you with these ideas and showing you how you could maybe develop them further. So I give like references and links and other videos to help you out or set you on your path what you might need. Yep. So as long as you know something exists, I guess you can always track it down further.
Yep. Yeah. We actually mentioned that on the show last week. I had my friend Charlie, who's an educator, on, and the what to Google for problem, right? And it's basically you're giving people a list of what to think about. It's almost like a checklist of things to think through. And then once you do that, it's like, all right, I want to know a ton about ESD. Well, this isn't where you learn that. You learn that on, you know, someone else's site.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Right? And it's like starting the spark or whatever you call it, right? Just just showing people this is what you probably will need. Here's the basics of choosing it. If you want any more detail, it's out there. But this is just like rules of thumb. I had one actually very good university lecturer. Mm-hmm. He was the only one who actually taught proper circuit design, and that especially also in analog electronics, when you're just designing circuitry that's supposed to work, not very precise circuitry, it's all about like rules of thumb. And I kind of like that approach, that you get given certain rough guidelines, and if you want, you can dive deeper.
Yeah.
So that's...
If I think back to like my time with the Keith Lee Analog Engineers, that was a lot of what I, you know, like we'd be sitting around a whiteboard, and I remember Matt, one of the guys that was older than me, not too much older, but had been there a while and definitely knew his stuff. And he'd always talk about these mantras, you know, just like, all right, we're talking through a circuit and we're like, all right, and we know that V equals LDI dt. And so because of that, when this inductor gets cut off over here, we're going to see a voltage spike. And it was just like ways that he would talk through circuits and these, you know, that's not really, that is an actual law, not a law, but like that is an equation around guiding voltages and stuff with inductors. But like having that as a mental model then to then build out the rest of your knowledge around the circuit is super, super useful.
Yes,
and I feel like the experience is just kind of like knowing where to apply that and how it's relevant to a circuit.
Yes. No, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, with the course, I hope that'll help some people out, just to set them on the right path.
I think you will be that guiding voice. Yeah. I think that's the idea.
Yes. Yeah. No, I do very much hope so. And of course, as always, any positive or negative feedback helps me out as much as it does people who you know sign up for the course, because I'm always still learning as well. I guess everyone is.
It's great. I think having those pointers to where to dive in deeper, and just follow along and see what you're doing, and hopefully is the idea that people should be following the course exactly and have the same output as what you're creating?
Close to. I mean, ideally I give the schematic files, I give the parts libraries, but I don't give the final board layout and board routing as part of the design, because that to me is the part which makes the most sense to do yourself, for every student to do themselves, just to go through the motions. Where do I put my vias? What traces do I use? Just watching will not teach you anything, I think. Like, I've always just learned the best by actually implementing what I've been taught.
Yeah.
Totally. So to me, that made the most sense not to include those files, because it's easy to say, yeah, he did it, I'm sure I can do it myself, mm-hmm. rather than having to do it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I used to do with Contextual Electronics is I would give them like a commit number. So I'd be like doing commits throughout the process. Each video would end with a, you know, I'd commit the code to GitHub. And so it's like, okay, so if you want to practice this specifically, go to the commit before or go to the commit after, delete all the stuff, and then start over from that same spot. And you just have like a part placement kind of thing. And then your parts are already placed. And you just do the layout, that sort of thing. Yeah.
No, I think that's, the great way, a really great way of learning. Actually, you have to do it to be able to learn this kind of stuff. So,
Yeah. Even though I'm not a gym goer, that is the equivalent of getting your reps in, I believe.
Exactly. There we go. only practice will
practice makes perfect. Is that what we're going towards?
I think so. Isn't that the usual saying?
Yeah. I'd say practice makes better.
Yes.
No perfect involved.
The limit tends to being perfect, but never gets
there. That's right. Yeah, right. It's a infinite series.
Yes. Yeah.
Cool. Philip, where can people find you, your course, your YouTube channel? How do people find you online?
Yeah, so if you just Google Phil's Lab or type Phil's Lab into YouTube, it should hopefully be the first thing that pops up. I also have videos on that channel to anything about hardware design and electronics, signal processing. You'll also find links to the course. If you want to go to the course, you can go to phils-lab.net/courses, and that'll show you all the course content, what you need to know, and also a link of where you can sign up. Awesome. So that should get people going.
We'll have some links on here as well. And I highly recommend checking out Philip's videos, and this course is a great next step to really dive in deeper. I think people could really benefit from that sort of thing.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. It's been great. It's been great to catch up with you and talk through education and electronics. I look forward to future videos and seeing what you do next.
It's been great to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Bye-bye.